Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. A week ago, the nation found out that there were over 331 million citizens counted in the 2020 census. And as many of us have experienced and probably participated in, North Carolina's population has grown significantly as well, to a little under 10.5 million, up from 9.5 million in the 2010 census. As a result, the state was one of several that were rewarded with an additional seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, marking the largest congressional delegation at 14 in the state's history. But along with the numbers have come several questions regarding the census, which we'll explore in depth today on this edition of Politics Monday with our guests. First, Dr. Rebecca Tippett is the founding director of Carolina Demography at the Carolina Population Center at UNC Chapel Hill, where she oversees the operation of the organization. Her work helps leaders across North Carolina make sense of population level changes throughout the state. And since 2017, her work and the work of Carolina Demography has largely focused on evaluating North Carolina's post-secondary educational pipeline. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. Dr. Sam Wong is a professor of neuroscience at Princeton University. In the mid-1990s, he worked on science and education policy for the U.S. Senate. He joined the Princeton University faculty in 2000. And while at Princeton, he has taken his data analytical understanding to found both the Princeton Election Consortium and the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, which does nonpartisan analysis to understand and eliminate partisan gerrymandering at a state-by-state level. He is the co-author of two popular books about the brain, including Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. Sam joins us from Princeton. Good morning.
Thanks, glad to be here.
And joining us for the first part of the show is Hansi Luong, who serves as a national correspondent for NPR, and I should say happy birthday, 50th birthday to NPR, where he reports on the people, power, and money behind the 2020 census. Hansi has received several awards, including the American Statistical Association's Excellence in Statistical Reporting Award for covering the Census Bureau and the Trump administration's push for a citizenship question. He joins us from New York City. Good morning, Hansi.
Good morning, Michael.
If you want to join our conversation on the census and the issues surrounding it, the subsequent reapportionment and redistricting, you can find us on Facebook, where we are streaming. You can also find us on Twitter at Charlotte Talks, or you can send us an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org. Hansi, I want to start with you. We know that the census and the 331 million citizens it found was conducted under a pandemic and very intense partisan fights. What else could we say is different about this year's census in comparison to the previous 23 counts the nation has done?
One thing to point out, that one thing that is not different is that the 331 million plus people were counted. That includes U.S. citizens as well as non-citizens, because the Constitution requires a count of every person living in the country, according to the 14th Amendment. And what was different this time around, obviously there was a pandemic, but also the Trump administration interfered with the Census Bureau's schedule by forcing the Census Bureau to cut short counting last summer, as well as putting pressure on the Bureau to cut short some early quality checks. That really upended an already very messy census that had to deal with how to send out in-person interviewers for door knocking to visit households that weren't likely to fill out a form themselves, how to do that in the middle of a pandemic when there are a lot of public health concerns, as well as the Trump administration's in the years leading up to the actual counting, a failed push to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census forms, a kind of question that the Census Bureau has known for decades is likely to discourage a lot of households with non-citizens from participating, possibly exacerbating the undercounting of historically undercounted groups, including immigrants, people of color, renters, other groups that have not been well represented in the numbers.
And why was the Trump administration pushing that citizenship question? What was behind that particular dynamic?
Ultimately, what I found out after looking through a lot of documents and tracking the administration for years, it was related in large part to an effort to exclude unauthorized immigrants from the numbers used to reallocate House seats, congressional seats, and electoral college votes among the states, even though the 14th Amendment requires the whole number of persons in each state to be included in those numbers. And in the entire history of the country, no person living in the country has ever been excluded because of their immigration status. But the Trump administration wanted to try to do this. President Trump actually put out a memo calling for this policy change, and that would have possibly shifted power and influence in Congress and Electoral College away from states with higher shares of unauthorized immigrants and towards states with a smaller share. Exactly how that would have played out, we don't know because it didn't happen. But that is why the Trump administration, according to my reporting, why they were interested, and certainly there were other theories about trying to discourage households with non-citizens from just participating in the census, as well as another theory that having a citizenship question on the 2020 census form would have produced data that a GOP redistricting strategist, Thomas Hoffler, said could have given Republicans a major advantage in state and local elections going forward for the next decade.
Okay. This is the first installment of the census data, the kind of big picture macro level. Later this year, we'll get the micro level data on states, even down to the local level. Rebecca, you work very closely with these numbers as a demographer. What are you looking forward to in getting once we get the next data that's released this year?
So there's a couple things that we're looking forward to there. The first, obviously, is going to be understanding the local population shifts, right? You know, in North Carolina, one of the things that we had is we're working with estimates at the end of the decade. And so there's some difference between where we thought the state was and where that number actually came in, which means that we're really going to be looking to see where does that difference then allocate across the state. You know, so we're looking to see kind of, is Wake officially larger than Mecklenburg? You know, that's going to be one of those new questions that we're going to examine. Which counties lost population? How much population did they lose? We're also going to be looking to see all this kind of standard statistics about age distribution, race and ethnicity, you know, household size and composition. But we're looking at a couple of new things in this census that for the first time ever, we're going to have information on same-sex partnerships in a census. And we also have that new kind of everybody was asked their ancestry. So we're going to have some new detail and nuance in the data coming from the census, not just when we're talking at the geographic level, but also in the characteristics of the population that's living here. So those are kind of the top level things. And then as we dig into it, we're probably going to start to find some really interesting patterns that will help us understand how and why the state has been changing. And obviously that same story is going to be playing out across the nation as we try to understand kind of the dynamics of population change.
Okay. Sam, we're continuing to see some dynamic trends and patterns continue in these early macro level census numbers, particularly the move from the Rust Belt to the Sun Belt. How is that going to impact how the dynamic of things politically play themselves out once these numbers get released?
Well, at a national level, it affects the possibilities for power in Congress. Seven seats changed in their allocation. Of course, as we have already heard in your state, North Carolina gained one congressional seat, and then other seats were lost, mostly in the Northeast, as you say, in Rust Belt states. I will say that the changes were smaller than expected. Before the announcement of the reapportionment results, it was predicted that something like 14 seats would change states. That's fairly typical for a decade-to-decade shift, but only seven changed, and that's seven is the lowest number of seats to change ever since in the last 100 years. The last time fewer seats changed was in 1920, when no seats changed at all because rural legislators basically stopped reapportionment from happening. So it's a smaller change than expected, but you know, Congress is really closely divided. I mean, flipping five seats from Democratic to Republican would change control of the House. So every little bit is going to matter. Reapportionment is basically the first step in this massive battle for who gets represented fairly. And you know, of course there's line drawing. And then when you add up all of that, it's not just getting represented locally in legislatures and in the House, but in national power. And so basically the ball dropped and the game has begun.
And we're going to get into the power of redistricting, the details later in the show. But Sam, you had mentioned what surprised you. I'm interested to hear from Hanzi and Rebecca, you know, what surprised you with both the national and the state counts in terms of what we were expecting and what we found out? Hanzi, if you'll start us off, what surprised you in terms of last week's announcement?
I think the most jaw-dropping number that came out of the Census Bureau's press conference was the number 89. That was a number of people that if people living in the state of New York, that if they were counted, if 89 more people were counted in New York for these apportionment numbers, New York would not have lost a seat in Congress. And another more astonishing number that came out after people did some math was a number 26. If 26 fewer people were counted in Minnesota's numbers, Minnesota would not have kept all of its 8 congressional seats. Wow. It was just the margins there were just remarkably close and close. In fact, the smallest margins ever seen since this formula was used after the 1940 census, this formula approved by Congress for reallocating House seats. And it really goes to show how every person living in the country really does count when it comes to how power is distributed in this country for determining how much power your state gets for making federal laws, as well as picking the next U.S. president for the next decade.
Okay, Rebecca, we're coming up on a break, but give us your surprise.
I think that for all that we talked about concerns about undercount, overcount, you know, all that, one of the big things that I think hasn't been talked on much has been how accurate the census was based on the demographic analysis estimates. You know, they're estimating nationally about a 0.35% undercount, which would put this a little bit behind the 2010 and the 2000 censuses, but much more accurate than any census that came before that. So I think that's important as we're talking about close margins and all these other kind of surprises from the estimates, keeping in mind that this looks like it was a very, on the whole, accurate census.
Hanzi, I want to end our time with you and talk about the fact that it's not just congressional seats, but it's also federal funding. Any idea how much money is tied into this count and what the policies are impacted by counting citizens?
We're talking about an estimated $1.5 trillion a year in federal funding for Medicare, Medicaid, education, infrastructure. This is an estimate produced by Andrew Reimer, a researcher at George Washington University. And it gives you a sense of just how extensive the use of census data are. And this is data that mostly what's guiding it is a second set of census results that haven't come out yet. They're expected by August 16th at this point. And so we're waiting for that information. And certainly the state population counts help guide that information, but it's all the data that coming out of the census that helps guide this major share of federal funding. And it's about a count of every person living in the country in order to determine how those funds get distributed in a way to meet communities' needs.
And real quickly, you understand that there are 2 lawsuits at least challenging these results?
Right. I just said by August 16th is when that second set of census results are expected. That's the redistricting data as well as data that helps guide a lot of federal funding. August 16th is what the Census Bureau is saying. There are 2 federal lawsuits that I'm tracking. Both of them, they're filed by the states of Alabama and Ohio. Both states' separate lawsuits are trying to get that date moved up. They are saying they need more time to prepare for redistricting and want that data as soon as possible, want it by the end of July. One extra complication here is that Alabama's lawsuit is also challenging the Census Bureau's way of keeping people's information confidential. That may delay the release of redistricting data.
That's Hanzi Luong of NPR News. We'll be back. This is Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Politics Monday on Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, and our focus is on the 2020 census, which had its initial release last Monday. We're talking with Dr. Sam Wong of Princeton University and Rebecca Tibbett of Carolina Demography at UNC Chapel Hill about the nation's count and the impacts that will be. I believe we still have Hanzi Luong on with us for just a few more minutes. But I wanted to ask Hanzi, in terms of what we're seeing with the next set of data, what specifically could we see come out of that particular result in August and September?
Well, the second set of 2020 census results includes the population numbers for counties, cities, towns, other smaller areas, as well as breakdowns, data breakdowns by race, ethnicity, age, and sex. What we have so far from last week's release of census results are really just state population numbers. So a very basic set of information. And this more detailed information is what redistrictors need to redraw voting districts, and what a lot of other researchers, as well as local city planners, for example, and demographers, what this is, the second set of information is really what gives us a fuller picture of where the country is, has been over the past decade, as well as possibly giving us a better sense of how accurate these numbers are ultimately, as well as the data and the count.
And that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you before you left, the accuracy of the census. The pandemic caused a huge amount of confusion, potential issues. Is it correct to say that not necessarily every American was surveyed? And if they weren't, how did the census capture their presence?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that no U.S. census in the history of this country has been perfect. And certainly for 2020, just as it has been for other decades, not every household was reached because possibly the Census Bureau didn't have that home address in their comprehensive list, or they tried to make it as comprehensive as possible list of addresses. The other aspect is there are a lot of folks who do not want to participate in the census because of low levels of trust with the government, with the census, or maybe they're not familiar with the census. So it requires a lot of effort, that on the ground, in-person outreach, door knocking, in order to reach certain households, which again was very difficult because of the pandemic last year. So the Census Bureau does have ways of trying to, alternative ways to gather information about those households, such as using government records. Sometimes those door knockers end up interviewing neighbors and landlords through what they call proxy interviews. All of these are certainly not as accurate, according to the Census Bureau's research, as volunteered information from households that fill out a form themselves or participate in an interview themselves. But these are alternative ways. And they're also, ultimately, the Census Bureau also uses a statistical method known as imputation, essentially using information that it does have on hand in order to make the best guess of who may be living in a household and their demographic characteristics in order to fill in those gaps.
Rebecca, you were quoted in a story that Hanzi wrote as saying, very small differences from state to state can be meaningful. And this has the potential to be that small difference for some states. If you're on the fence of possibly getting a congressional seat or possibly losing a seat, every possible person counts. How do demographers deal with this fact that not necessarily everybody got counted, but we're using some estimation in the process?
Yeah, so I think that's where we're starting to look at the quality metrics. I mean, one of the challenges is that I mentioned before that we kind of have, at a high level, we think it was a pretty accurate census, like some suggestions that there's a small undercount. But what we're really looking to now are something that's called the differential undercount. So what we really want to start to understand is, okay, we think we got everybody in general, but were there certain groups that were more missed than other groups? And we know historically that college students, white older adults are more likely to be counted twice, whereas other groups, maybe Latinos, Black individuals, young children are less likely to be counted at all. So we have we have some historic trends there. I think there are some concerns in particular that I know Dr. Wong had written about recently, and Hanzi's already mentioned around, the possibility for an undercount of Hispanics in this census would be possibly worse than prior decades. But, what we're really talking about here is, it's really hard to count everybody once and only once and in the right place. And we're looking at all this data that's going to be coming out alongside the counts to try to understand, where do we think there was an undercount? How much do we think there was an undercount? And then can we help communities address that data either through kind of what's a count resolution process, right? Can they help challenge that? Or can we, you know, I think the challenge and the reason I'm kind of coming up short here is that there is not a statistical adjustment that's allowed in the census. So even if we know that there's an undercount, they're not allowed to make corrections for that. So I think that's important to know as well, that that's why that mobilization, the getting everybody out and counting, is really important on the front end. And that's why I think a lot of demographers are out advocating for census participation on the front end, because we know that we have to then live with that data for a decade.
Anzi, is there going to be any kind of quality checks performed on the existing data that we know about?
Well, the Census Bureau says that it has been performing quality checks, and that's why those results that came out last week came out 4 months past when they were originally expected by the end of last year. And the Census Bureau is still doing more quality checks, it says, for the second set of results, which were due, this redistricting data was due by the end of March. But now the Census Bureau is now planning for mid-August because it says it needs more time to run quality checks. Specifically, there are a lot of duplicate and incomplete responses that the Census Bureau needs to sort through and figure out what actually happened with those responses in order to produce as complete and accurate data as possible. So the Census Bureau says it's taking as much time as it can.
And in one of the lawsuits, I believe it's the Alabama lawsuit, along with South Carolina and 14 other states, they talk about the issue of the distorting impact of differential privacy will likely fall hardest on some of the most vulnerable populations, rural areas, and minority racial groups. This was one of the groups that Rebecca just talked about. Hanzi, what do we know about the status of this particular lawsuit, and what could be the impact of it going on with the data that should be coming out in August?
I think we should take a step back here, that what Alabama is challenging is a new way that the Census Bureau is planning to use for keeping people's personal information in anonymized census data confidential. And the Census Bureau is hoping to use this new way known as differential privacy. And the impact of how differential privacy, exactly how that will affect redistricting data as well as the other sets of data within, well, essentially the second set of census results, is really unclear at this point. What Alabama is challenging and other states are really concerned about are based on demonstration data, essentially test cases that the Census Bureau has put out so far, and various researchers, demographers have been looking at that data, analyzing how it compares, and so we're not quite sure exactly what the effects are because the Census Bureau has not yet finalized exactly how it will apply differential privacy to that data. That decision is expected by early June. However, this is already in the courts. There's a hearing today in Montgomery, Alabama, before a three-judge panel that could decide on a request for an emergency court order that would stop the Bureau's plans from continuing to work on this new way of keeping people's information confidential. And that could really throw the timeline for redistricting data, that second set of results, even more up in the air and make it even more uncertain. So something I'm watching.
That's Hanzi Luong of NPR News. I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you for all the insight that you've given us.
You're very welcome, Michael.
Rebecca and Sam, I want to come to you about this idea of differential privacy. Rebecca, could you talk a little bit about what exactly this is? And Sam, what I'd like to do is follow up with you on what the, if any, potential impact will be on redistricting. But Rebecca, could you give us just a kind of average layman's terms in terms of what we're talking about with this approach that the census is taking?
Yeah, so I think it's important to keep in mind, like, there's a couple things. So the first thing is the Census Bureau's commitment to protecting the privacy and the confidentiality of respondents, right? So it has always had a commitment to that, and there have always been methods by which they protect that data. So some of those are known as kind of whole household swapping. So for example, I think the case that's been pointed out is, you know, the couple that lives at the base of the Staten Island, their direct responses to the census may not be reported verbatim because that would allow people to kind of fully identify them based on those responses in the geographic location. So the Bureau has always done some level of what would be called kind of injecting some noise into the data to protect the privacy of individuals. What's happening now is that differential privacy is a much more algorithmic kind of a formalization of this process, where they're essentially making a trade-off on one hand between all data is like fully known and there's no privacy, versus everything's completely private, but there's really no information given in the data. And they're kind of using a mathematical formula to kind of set what they're calling the privacy budget, and then allocate kind of noise based on that. And there's a lot of decision-making that's been going on. They've been testing that a lot, but the fact of the matter is, like, it's essentially they're injecting noise into the data to protect privacy. It's a slightly different way of doing it than they have done in the past, but this is consistent with kind of approaches that they've taken over the past decades to protect respondent confidentiality.
And Sam, in the lawsuit, Alabama and other states are alleging that this might have an impact on redistricting. Any sense of what that could be, if any, on the potential data that's coming out later this fall?
Sure. You know, these lawsuits get filed with claimed reasons, but one should sometimes look underneath the surface. So I'll give you an example. The Trump administration said that it wanted to add a citizenship question to the census for purposes of enforcing the Voting Rights Act, but the Supreme Court said that that was a pretext and didn't really make much sense, and so ordered the question struck. And so one should be careful about the face value interpretation. Now, the Alabama lawsuit says that fuzzing out the data a little bit, as Dr. Tippett has, she used a more correct term for it, but adding a little bit of uncertainty so that you, I'll give you an example, in a certain block, say, I don't know, in the Sand Hills region of North Carolina, we know that there are 27 people, and that'll stay the same. But without this fuzzing out noise, it might not be possible to say, well, is there a 14-year-old undocumented young man of certain ethnicity in the Sand Hills region? And that information will be much harder to back out with differential privacy. So to your question, will this added privacy come with the burden of making it harder to draw fair district lines? In terms of numbers of people, no, because that's something that gets kept. I think it's an open question whether it is will be continuing to be fair to persons of color, other specific communities of interest. And there are groups working with this demonstration data that I believe Hansi Lo Wang or Dr. Tippett mentioned. That demonstration data is going to let data-oriented groups like mine at Princeton understand whether it's going to have an adverse effect on estimating racial composition of districts, whether legislative or state. I would say there's some preliminary evidence from the Census Bureau that it's not going to have a big effect, but the effect will not be zero. And so the question is it going to be so small that we're not going to notice it, in which case it's okay. And I would just say it needs watching. Anyone who is interested in fair districting is obviously going to be interested in knowing whether this is an issue or not. And we're going to figure it out in the next month because we need to do it pretty quick.
Gotcha. Kevin on Facebook asked the question, and I'll pose this to Rebecca. How large was the gap between the expected population number in North Carolina and the actual census result?
Yeah, so our expected number was, we were expecting a population of somewhere closing on 7.6 million, and our actual population came in around 7.4, just over that, the difference being 140,000 or about 1.3%. So that, like I said, was a surprise, right? So our 2020 census number came in below the 2019 population estimate is what was going on there. So as I think I alluded to previously, the big question is going to become when we're talking about our county populations, that means that there's 140,000 fewer people within North Carolina to allocate to our counties. So the real question becomes, was that our fast growing counties are not picking up as many people as we thought? Did our counties that were losing population lose more people than we thought? Or some, more likely, some combination of those two, right? I think that that's what we're really looking forward to more keenly in the fall. Had that number come in right around where we thought it was going to be, I mean, there's always some flux, but if it was closer to where we thought it was going to be, we'd have a little bit more confidence starting to play in for possibly reallocation of like the new congressional seat, the state House and Senate districts. But as it is, I think we're going into that with more questions now than we would have had that number been a little closer.
And it's not just the congressional districts, it's not just state legislative districts. As I mentioned to Hansi, it's also public policy issues. What impacts might this have on things like education, things like roads? Are there some substantial impacts that way as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the real concern, right, is that if there's, so right now, North Carolina gets about $42 billion a year in federal, in census-derived kind of federal funds, or census-directed federal funds. And obviously that ends up being somewhere over about $4,000 per person. So I think the concern is that if the 140,000 fewer people, if that's because we had an overestimate going in and that was our true population, that's great. The concern becomes of, is that, what are we missing those people because maybe we didn't do as good of a job mobilizing our rural communities during coronavirus, or that there was an undercount that impacted North Carolina more than some other states. Then we have a concern that not just is it the politics, but that means that we're missing out on deserved federal dollars, right, that should be going to the population in that state for those services. And the other concern we have is we know that these things, if the undercount or an overcount is kind of equally likely to occur in any place, it's a problem, but it's not a big problem in terms of fair distribution of resources. But because that undercount tends to be, some communities are more likely to be undercounted than others, that means that not just at the state level might we be missing out on kind of our full federal share of funds, but that then we can't allocate it appropriately within the state to the communities that need those resources.
Okay. We're one of the other aspects is going to be the racial and ethnic dynamics. We know that the American population is continuing to diversify. What do we expect, Sam, in terms of thinking about how that dynamic is going to play out once we get some of these known numbers?
Yeah, so right now what we have, of course, is state-level estimates. As we've heard earlier from Hansi Lo Wang, mid-August is when we expect to get more granular, detailed data. I will tell you that there are some patterns that arise in the national data that we could perhaps apply to North Carolina. My team has done some simple correlations just to figure out what's going on. One is that even though these errors are not very large, as Dr. Tippett has pointed out, they tend to be larger in states with large rural populations, and North Carolina has a large rural population. And so that's a reasonably strong correlation. There also is some amount of undercount, it seems, in states with large Hispanic populations, and that's Florida, Texas, Arizona, also Nevada and Colorado. And so those are populations that where it may matter. And so I'd say those are things to watch out for.
We'll pick that up after the break. This is Charlotte Talks. And welcome back to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, where it's Politics Monday, about the U.S. Census and the early dynamics of our nation's count, particularly related to redistricting. We're joined by Drs. Rebecca Tibbett with the UNC Chapel Hill Carolina Demography and Sam Wong with Princeton University's Gerrymandering Project. If you've got questions about the census or redistricting, find us on Facebook or Twitter, or send us an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org. Sam, you before the break, you were talking about the potential rural populations and how they may be undercounted. North Carolina has a very significant portion of its population in rural communities. How exactly could this be an impact on those communities?
Well, as we heard before the break, as Dr. Tippett has pointed out, billions of dollars per year go to federal funding. And then, of course, there's the question of redistricting and representation. When state legislative districts are drawn, North Carolina has lots of special rules on that topic, detailed rules. But a rule that's general in all states is that the average population of a district within the state should be the same in each district, plus or minus about 5%. So if rural communities are undercounted, then they are at some, I would say, mildly elevated risk of underrepresentation. If they're undercounted, then their districts will be too large physically for fair representation. So I think that's something that's going to need to be looked at by Dr. Tippett and the kind of granular expertise that's available in North Carolina.
Right. And Rebecca, there are some other aspects. We know from the 2019 census estimates that North Carolina was reported to be 62% non-Hispanic white, 22% Black or African American, and almost 10% Hispanic Latino. Any thoughts on what we might expect when we get the detailed numbers in terms of race and ethnicity in this state?
I would expect it to look pretty in line with that, with one caveat, is that the fact that this was the first time that all individuals were invited to write ancestral origins in, and that there are ways in which that may increase, for example, the likelihood of people having been identified as multiracial, right? Having coded two or more races, because they're going to be encouraged to kind of write a lot of that in. That was a slightly different question than had been tested by the Bureau going into 2020. So I think we're expecting to see that, about 1 in 10 North Carolinians will be identifying as Hispanic or Latino. Our state remains about a fifth or to a quarter of the population identifies as Black. Obviously, we have a very large American Indian population as well. So we're kind of expecting to see that trend. And then the real thing will be looking at exactly what that looks like within our different age groups, which I think this will give us an opportunity to understand some of how the ways of self-identification are different across age groups, because we know that, a lot of the way that people are identifying has been changing, but also, when we have a diversifying adult population, we have a much more diverse child population. And so one of the big changes that we've seen in the child population in the most recent years has been really the growth of multiracial children. But then as they age into adulthood, understanding how they identify going forward, I think we're in a real kind of interesting dynamic time in the state, and North Carolina is really starting to look more like the nation in terms of its population composition than it has in its history.
And certainly one of the things that North Carolina looks like with the nation as a whole is certainly the dynamic of redistricting and the partisan and political implications of that particular activity. That will have to wait, of course, until the detailed information comes out before the North Carolina General Assembly can start that process. But Sam, could you walk us through kind of the basics of redistricting? This is certainly something that we're going to be covering a lot in this next year, or perhaps even further if North Carolina's past history is any indication. What should the listeners know about just the basics of what we see happening in redistricting activities?
Of course. Well, the Constitution requires that districts be drawn of equal population. This stems from the 14th Amendment, which specifies one person, one vote, at least in the Supreme Court's interpretation, and specifies that people's votes should not be diluted by being packed into districts with too many people. And so the fundamental requirement, therefore, leads to the fact that after each census, every state in the nation has to redraw its legislative districts, and if it has more than one congressional district, its congressional districts, and North Carolina is no different. So that minimal fairness requirement was long thought to be enough to protect voting rights, at least at a fundamental level. But then there's also the Voting Rights Act, which specifies additional protections for certain racial groups that have been hurt in the past. It turns out there's a huge amount of discretion that legislators have in fairness, something like, I would say, even if everyone voted, even if everyone registered to vote, something like a third of the legislative seats in any state are at the mercy of the people who draw the lines and not the voters. And what it means that is that there's an enormous amount of power and influence at stake. And of course, North Carolina has been ground zero for some of the most bitter battles in redistricting. And so I think that whatever may have happened with the census, the real battle is ahead, and this fall is going to have enormous implications for who gets represented in North Carolina and how.
And part of your project with the gerrymandering project is to ensure fair districts. You've probably gotten this question before many times, but I'm just fascinated to know what brought a professor of neuroscience into the fields of gerrymandering and elections.
Well, it is true that I'm appointed to neuroscience down the hall here at Princeton as my laboratory, and we do that full time. But I'm also a citizen, and I work with data for a living. My background's in physics, and I started doing election analytics in 2004, both presidential and otherwise. In 2012, I realized that despite one party, the Democrats, getting more votes in congressional elections, the other party, the Republicans, gained more seats. And that struck me as counterintuitive. How could a majority vote end up getting a minority of seats? And I looked into this and I started realizing that in fact redistricting had so much power. And I gathered like-minded people. We started trying to influence the process using data, using analytics. I've had to learn things that are outside my domain, like constitutional law. And I would say, I am certainly the person who knows the third most about North Carolina demographics and geography in this conversation, but I'm a less distant third than I would be otherwise. So I am, you know, fairness depends on the details. And my team here, which you can read about at gerrymander.princeton.edu, is very into districting fairness now in all its glory.
What exactly do you mean by districting fairness? What I mean, we hear, and particularly with the 2010 cycle in North Carolina, the mantra put forward by state legislative Republican leaders was fair and legal. We had several court cases that challenged the legality of those maps. As usual, North Carolina went through several iterations of the maps. What is the idea of fairness in partisan dynamics of redistricting? And we should mention gerrymandering.
I will say that in that phrase you just came up with, fair and legal, the word legal is doing a lot of work there.
I didn't come up with it.
I'm just saying.
Senator Rucho and Representative Lewis.
Yeah. So fair and legal, the emphasis is legal because there's a wide latitude of maps that are legal depending on how entities like state Supreme Courts and other courts and of course other laws and the laws dictate. So for example, it is perfectly legal under federal doctrine to take all the, to take as many members as possible, one party in North Carolina, the Democrats, and pack those Democrats into a few districts so they only get a few wins. And then to spread out Republican voters more evenly and efficiently so they get lots of wins. And so up until last year, North Carolina's congressional delegation was 10 Republicans, 3 Democrats, despite the fact that North Carolina is pretty closely divided. So by federal doctrine, that is perfectly legal. In state doctrine is a little bit up in the air, but as you all know, North Carolina got redrawn and I believe it's now 8-5. Which is, you know, about what you would expect. I mean, the difficulty is that a fair map requires lots of things. It's not just favoring Republicans versus Democrats. It's also racial representation. It's making sure that counties don't get split up too much, that districts aren't funny shapes. And so it's a complicated game. And I think that any slogan or, you know, brief talking point has difficulty capturing that richness. And so so I think that, it's a contentious subject. And the ideal case is one in which different parties and groups have a seat at the table, which is tough because in most states, legislators are in charge and legislators do not always represent all the interests in an equal manner.
Rebecca, one of the real dynamics when it comes to redistricting here in North Carolina is the urban, suburban, rural dynamic that has been so much talked about and is really kind of centered in the state's political divisions. What do you see moving forward as that dynamic plays out? And once we get the local data, what do you expect to see in terms of how urban, rural, suburban North Carolina is really looked at?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing that we can say with near certainty is that no matter how the numbers exactly play out, is we're going to see a shift in political power and representation into urban and suburban areas and away from rural areas, just because of a few factors. One is that our urban areas have been growing more quickly, and our rural areas have, in many cases, even if they have not been losing population, have not really been growing. But two, because of what's kind of a rural to urban conversion, is that as our places become more populated and as urban growth spills over, places that were previously maybe rural become more suburban or eventually urban in their character. So I think we're going to see kind of that shift, continued shift. Again, I want to point out here that North Carolina remains more rural than the nation, but what we're doing is we're really kind of moving into alignment with this broader national average, but we'll really understand the magnitude of that shift a little bit more when we get some of those numbers. So yeah, we're really looking to that to understand exactly how much that shift is going to matter. But I like that Dr. Wong emphasized this, and I just want to underscore it, is, you know, when we're talking about drawing the maps, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of ways to draw a legitimate map, right? And I think that when we come down to figuring out does this map capture our communities of interest? I know, Dr. Bitzer, you and I have talked about this a little bit. You know, there's lots of different ways that we can define a community of interest. There's lots of ways that we can even define what it means to be urban versus suburban or rural in the state. And I think that what it really necessitates is a lot of kind of hard conversations about what do we want out of these maps? You know, what do we want them to accomplish? And that really kind of means engaging a full complement of the population and both parties in that conversation and kind of drawing those maps.
Sam, how have other states taken particularly this idea of communities of interest into play in their redistricting? Oftentimes, you know, legislators will say, this is one of our factors, or this is one of our redistricting criteria, but it seems like it gets dismissed just as easily when the lines start to be drawn.
Yeah, as we said before, legislators have lots of interests to respond to, including their own for political survival. But communities of interest is a concept that is getting used. Academic research has shown that it gets used both by commissions and by legislators. And increasingly, citizens have it in their power to report their communities of interest. There are tools for doing this. Some students here at Princeton have developed a tool that you can read about at representable.org. And it's been adopted in something like half a dozen states, including redistricting commissions. There are other tools such as Dave's redistricting app and District R. District Builder, just many tools out there. They all share the common feature that citizens can go to the map on a computer, draw a boundary set that says, here's who we are in the Sandhills. Here's who we are, the Hispanic community of, I don't know, Carrboro or someplace like that. Farmers of some part of Western North Carolina. And document it, upload it, create a common database. I think a key part of redistricting all over the country, including North Carolina, is going to involve citizens using such tools like representable.org to report who they are, where they are, and being part of the conversation. And I think it's absolutely critical because voting rights are so complicated.
And one of the things about this idea of citizen input, just this weekend, a news article in the Charleston Post and Courier says that South Carolina Democrats have introduced a bill, what they're calling the Fairness, Accountability, and Integrity in Redistricting, or FAIR, maybe that's the new definition act, that will enshrine in state law the principles to redrawing state districts. There's little hope that it'll pass. But the Senate Majority Leader, Shane Massey, said, quote, we've got to have public input. There's no question about that. Sam, what can states like North Carolina do now to incorporate citizen views on how districts should be drawn?
Well, the public comment periods are going to be critical. What they can do is budget enough time to put out a draft plan and allow public input. There should be public input before the first draft plan is drawn, because once that draft gets released, then it gets kind of gelled in people's minds and it's hard to really deviate from it. I think that as Rebecca has said, there are thousands, if not millions, of possible maps. And it is important to get citizen input early. If it's by computer, not just narrative comments like comment threads, like you would see on a YouTube video, but actual portals to allow the uploading of maps, details, names of counties and communities. Really, if legislators can open up the way to do that, by setting up a portal, I think that could play a critical role as early as possible. And as I said, time for public comment, time for independent organizations to score a map, to evaluate how well it treats different communities. I think it's gonna be a group effort. And you know, North Carolina citizens seem pretty mobilized from up here in New Jersey. You all look pretty, pretty energetic about these things.
And we will have constant conversations about this, I dare say, for the next year, if not extending more. That's Sam Wong from Princeton Gerrymandering Project, along with Rebecca Tippett from the North Carolina Demography. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.